Hi, it's Patrick Cox here in Boston with another World in Words. Today, an exposé of the woeful state of English language teaching in France. Also, the civil war in Sri Lanka is over, which gives those of us with almost total ignorance about that country a chance to find out about the linguistic differences there. And what is potato-ness?
One judge in the case said the issue begged, quote, an Aristotelian question. Does the product have an essence of potato?
As a free man, I take pride in the word, ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
My name is Matthew Fitt, I'm from Dundee, I'm a writer, but I didn't bite in Dundee anymore, I bite in a toon card bigger in the south of Scotland.
The World, otherwise known as The Big Show, is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International and WGBH in Boston. That is where I am right now. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 260 public radio stations around the United States. If you don't catch us on the radio, listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out all of our other podcasts and many other things besides. Today, English language teaching in France. An American discovers that the French system of selecting the best English teachers actually discriminates against native English speakers. Also, the languages of Sri Lanka and the role they play in the tensions between the two main ethnic groups there. And a ruling in a tax court over Pringles chips and their potato-ness. I kid you not. So first, teaching English in France. You may be surprised to learn, I certainly was, that kids at French public schools don't do very well when it comes to learning English. The Dutch, the Norwegians, the Spanish too, they all outperform French kids. And this is, not surprisingly, a matter of considerable consternation among French parents. But it took an outsider, an American, to get to the heart of the problem. Her name is Laurel Zuckerman. She's the author of a book called Sorbonne Confidential. It was actually a bestseller in France. It's just been translated and published in English. Zuckerman is a longtime resident of France. She's married to a Frenchman with kids being raised essentially French. She decided that she wanted to train as a public school English teacher. Here's her story.
I had been working in France for about a dozen years in computer technologies. And I lost my job when the dot-com bubble burst. And I thought, this is a great occasion to change professions. And why not teach? And so it was a kind of a light-hearted decision, you could say. And I didn't realize that it would be as difficult as it turned out to be. So I registered for this exam, what's called the Agrégation d'Anglais, which is the premier, most prestigious competitive exam that they have for teachers in France, and discovered an entire world.
A world of what?
A world that was actually pretty absurd, because the exam turned out to have absolutely nothing to do with teaching and not all that much to do with English. So it was a very selective exam, very difficult. There were lots of things that you had to learn to prepare for the exam, and people spend an entire year and sometimes several years preparing for the exam. But even those who succeed don't actually know anything about teaching at the end of the process.
Yeah, that was something that struck me as really odd, that there was a real emphasis on theory and not much on classroom practicalities.
Yeah, there was absolutely nothing about classroom practicalities, because the whole point of it is to select civil servants. This all goes back to the exam that was put into place by Louis XV in 1766, when he threw the Jesuits out of France and he needed all of a sudden to find people to teach. So they put into place this exam, which kind of changed over time. But the basic idea is to select. It's not to train people how to teach. It's to select people who have certain capacities. And over time, it expanded and expanded. It eventually became this gigantic machine. You have the exams. There's both an exam called the Agrégation, which is what I took, which is the highest exam, and the CAPES, which is the general teaching exam. And every year you have 100,000 people in France in 37 different subjects who are trying to pass these exams. And they know in advance how many civil servant positions are available. And so they know in advance that 1 in 10 or 1 in 11 are actually going to succeed. So all of the years of preparation actually go to waste for 90% of the people.
Right. And not to give too much away, but you turned out to be one of those 90% of people.
I was in the majority.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about how much emphasis was placed on English as opposed to French in the preparation for this exam?
Well, that was one of the things I found absolutely fascinating, that you actually had slightly more non-English content than English content. You had a not quite a 50-50 split, because you also had several points of the exam which were in linguistics and phonetics, where you actually had to learn a special phonetic code. So I categorized that as neither French nor English. But you could theoretically pass the exam if you didn't get a zero on any subject with almost nothing at all in English and everything in French.
And were there some colleagues of yours, French students, whose English perhaps you might have noticed wasn't so good, who nonetheless did rather well in the exam?
That's not so surprising. Yes, of course, that's true. What's so surprising is that sometimes there were professors whose English wasn't that good. And so you would have a professor who would mispronounce a word just again and again and again, who might be quite a wonderful professor. I mean, there was one who was an excellent professor of culture, civilization, history, but she was constantly mispronouncing key words and nobody dared to correct her. And so all of the students then learned how to mispronounce the words too. For example, Lutheran was Lutherian. So you have a generation of students who say Lutherian.
Yeah, and then there was the guy who insisted that the plural of the word duck, the animal duck, is duck.
Yes, duck are like fish. Yeah, that was an inspector, actually, after the exam, who came in to inspect one of the students who I thought was particularly brilliant. I thought she was really very, very gifted. And she was quite disheartened because she'd been inspected and gotten a bad result. And when I asked her about it, she said, yes, and I made this terrible mistake. I said that the plural of duck is ducks, and I was told that that was wrong. And it took her several days to look it up in the dictionary. And there was nothing she could say. The inspector said it was like that, so it was like that.
Now, you present the case in your book that native English speakers, including people who spoke French fluently, were in fact discriminated against through this entire process. How did that play itself out?
Well, it's not a direct discrimination. I have to be very clear. It's not that they would see an English speaker coming and say, no, not this one. It wasn't as direct as that. It's a mechanism whereby, because of the content of the exam, they're already looking for a certain kind of person, and that certain kind of person masters certain arcane knowledge that only someone who has come up through the French system can know. For example, the French dissertation or dissertation is a very specific art form that really takes some time and some cultural conditioning to learn. And so to include the French dissertation in an English exam automatically skews the result towards people who master the French dissertation. It's more things like that. I did have professors who told me, do be very careful, because if they see in your writing, if they can tell through your writing that you're a native English speaker, they might grade you more harshly. But that's not something that's actually possible to prove. But what you can say is that if they really wanted to choose people who knew how to speak English and knew how to teach it, it would not be the same exam.
That, to me, I find quite shocking, because it's a fairly standard assumption in language teaching circles that you're better off if you're being taught by a native speaker.
Not in France, it isn't. In France, they've constructed this whole, I don't want to say exactly ideology, but let's say this idea that if you're a native speaker, because you've never taken the time to really take apart the language and understand what kind of obstacles a learner might encounter, you can't explain the grammar properly. This, I think, is quite false, actually. And what they have in France is kind of a system where it's very closed system. I think they started erecting more barriers when the European Union decreed that people from different European countries should be able to work in all of the member countries of Europe. And so you had in about, I think it was 1993, you had a European decree which said that from now on, an English person or a Dutch person or a German person should be able to work in France and compete for these jobs. And that's when you started having all kinds of language quotas being introduced in France. You had the Loi Toubon, which said that companies would actually be fined if they started using English. You had the introduction of, and it was a new thing, the French, what they call the French leçon, that is, as part of the aggregation exam, you actually had to give a half an hour lecture in French, which is one of the things that when English teaching in France was evaluated, they said was a terrible problem that for French teachers of English, in that they spent all their time speaking French in the class. Well, they introduced a component in the exam which made them have to speak French and give a long lecture in French in order to become teachers. And I think they then saw the results among the people who went out into the classroom and spoke too much French.
Well, maybe we could just pick off a couple of those points just to set this broader context. The learning of English in France is indeed a priority for the French government.
Absolutely.
Which makes it very different from the status of a language like French here in the United States, which is, I mean, it's considered very nice if you want to learn French, but it's not a true priority in your basic education.
It's absolutely impossible to compare the situation of the two. You're completely right. The French government has said now repeatedly, and particularly under Sarkozy, that French children must learn how to speak English as a matter of French competitiveness in the world, and that children who do not learn English are disadvantaged unfairly. So there's a broad recognition that it's absolutely crucial that the children learn English. So on one hand, you have the government, which has clearly recognized that it's absolutely essential to learn English. And on the other hand, you have these kind of old fears and old hesitations and certain elites who are very uncomfortable with this, who are constantly engaging in a rearguard action.
Right, so it's a kind of a linguistic tug of war.
Absolutely.
Within France itself, protectionism.
Within France itself, yeah. This has absolutely nothing to do with America or Britain or any other external country. It's a battle that's being fought entirely within France by the French.
And did you find that after your book came out, that sort of brought the debate a little bit more to the fore insofar as, you know, he was an outsider talking about something that was an internal debate?
Absolutely. I mean, France is a country of taboos. And if the book has any merit at all, I think it's to have simply described what I saw with absolutely no taboos. A lot of people, of course, knew that the system functioned as I described it. And a lot of people have come to me and said, yes, this is exactly what happens. But no one would say it. It's one of these things where the emperor has no clothes. And the taboo that's being broken here is the idea of the meritocracy and the idea of the competitive exam selecting the very best. And because the competitive exam is so extremely difficult, the idea is, therefore, those selected must be the best. And what I show in the book through my experiences is that even though this exam is indeed very difficult, it's not selecting at all the best. In fact, it might be selecting the wrong people, and it might even be damaging people who are quite excellent through the process.
Laurel Zuckerman, author of Sorbonne Confidential. Here's a passage from the book, and I think this nicely illustrates exactly what's wrong with the way French universities and native French-speaking professors, how they prepare students for a lifetime of teaching English.
Class started. We were translating into French a passage by a writer named Jess Walter from a novel called Land of the Blind. The text described a senior prom in an American high school. Think monstrueux, monstrous, the professor urged us. Kitsch, hideux, grotesque. Students competed actively to dig up the most derisive vocabulary until they were stumped by ruffled shirts. Even the professor was at a loss. He stopped, tilted his lovely head, tried one solution after another, none satisfactory. His difficulty with ruffled shirts was evident. Despite his own agrégé status and near-perfect English, he had no idea what they were. In fact, the text was full of obscure references. Sixers, bong, tuxedo t-shirt, cruising. People in France have seen images of proms in Hollywood movies like Grease and Carrie, but the concept, not just of the prom, but of the whole American high school experience, is so foreign as to defy comprehension. In France, 16-year-olds do not have cars. They do not drive. Preparation for passing the driver's test costs 600 euros and many months of study with a professional. In the French public high schools, there are no school dances. The closest one gets to a prom is an aristocratic happening called a rallye. The whole point of a rallye is its exclusivity. Not only do the kids who care about such events get to worry about what to wear, with whom to go, and the specter of pimples on the big night, but about whether they will even be invited at all.
Yep, you definitely need a native speaker slash cultural translator for some of those terms, like cruising and bong. Next week, Laurel Zuckerman talks about how French parents pleaded with her to teach their children English because the English classes at the schools that their kids were going to were so bad. Later in the podcast, what constitutes potato-ness? First, the languages of Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka doesn't get in the news unless there's a tsunami. The civil war there has been raging for decades. It's only now, as the government has apparently won a decisive victory over the separatist Tamil Tigers, that the country is actually in the headlines. Earlier this week, we invited two Sri Lankans onto the big show, two guys who speak two different languages, Sinhala, which is spoken by most Sri Lankans, and Tamil. The interviewer is Marco Werman.
LTT Nayaka Velupille Prabhakaran ge Malasiruhamu Bava Rajay Prakash Tapatkarai.
That's a clip from today's Sinhala language news broadcast from our production partner, the BBC World Service. It also has a daily broadcast in Sri Lanka's other main language,
Tamil.
Both broadcasts are reporting extensively on the news out of Sri Lanka. The Tamil and Sinhala news teams work closely together to bring international news to Sri Lanka's two main language groups. The editors of the two language services actually share a desk. They are Maniwanan Tirumalai, who runs the BBC's Tamil service, and Priyat Lianage, who runs the Sinhala service. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I have to say, first of all, I have a really hard time imagining what the office politics have been like, especially in the last week. What about today, for example? The president of Sri Lanka named today a holiday so people could celebrate the military's victory against the Tamil Tigers. Mani, I mean, you're with the Tamil service. It's hard to imagine the Tamil broadcast being totally celebratory in its coverage. Am I right?
It cannot be celebratory whether it is Tamil or Sinhala. It doesn't really matter which language we are broadcasting. And even if you are an English outlet, you can't celebrate these kind of things. The point is, we treated it as a news. And, you know, the Sri Lankan president declares a holiday to celebrate the victory over what he calls his terrorism. That's fine. We treat it as such. And it doesn't mean that that kind of celebration should percolate to the Tamil section of the BBC.
Mani, have you ever disagreed with your colleagues over in the Sinhala service on how a story should be covered?
Not only in the Sinhala service, even in Tamil team as well. These are professional disagreements. These are not ethnic disagreements, I would say. If there is a particular story on which the Sinhala colleague and I differ, we do discuss it professionally and try to, you know, arrive at some kind of a neutral ground about how we can treat the story in our programs. It's not about taking sides, basically. It's about what kind of an angle you take to tell the story to your own audiences.
It sounds like one big happy family. Maybe the government of Sri Lanka should have come to the services of the BBC to find out how to get along.
They should come. They are very welcome to do so.
It's kind of ironic that we're talking with two gentlemen from the two language services from who represent Sri Lanka, because wasn't the issue of language rights something that sparked this conflict years ago to begin with?
Yes, it was in the 1956, the Sinhala Only Act. That it's not about language policies alone. It's about the minority Tamils' sense of alienation from the state, their representation in various government services, including the Sri Lankan army, the police, the judiciary, etc. And of course, provincial autonomy, more powers for the provinces. So these are major political issues. And if the Sri Lankan government addresses these grievances in a meaningful way, I'm sure there would be, you know, the future would be bright for Sri Lanka.
Priyat, do you share those concerns?
The thing is, there are so many different issues. There are professionals who are Tamils, there are judges, there are ministers, there are doctors, engineers, but it is, I think, in the poorer classes who are living in the north of Sri Lanka, in the east of Sri Lanka, who are not getting the opportunities and who are actually being exploited by politicians. And the nationalism and the race issue had been a huge issue in politics, and it's been exploited by politicians throughout the last few decades.
How different are the two languages, Sinhala and Tamil?
Well, they are very different. Sinhala traces its origins to a family of Indo-European family of languages called, you know, it has its roots in Sanskrit, I think. But Tamil belongs to a separate family of languages called the Dravidian languages, of which Tamil is the mother, and other Dravidian languages are its offshoot, like Malayalam, Telugu and Kannada, which are all spoken in South India. They are different, and the script is different, grammar is different. Definitely, they are very, very different languages.
And Sinhala is a language only spoken in Sri Lanka. It is what you call Indo-Aryan languages, which has Sanskrit base. So it is also the mother language for languages like even German. But it had come from north of India. So while the Tamil language had come from south of India, so there is a gap. So there is no connection between the two languages. Over the thousands of years where the languages were spoken side by side, so there are words and things that we share. But not many people who are living in Sri Lanka will understand each other's language. So the only common language in Sri Lankan context would be English, what we got from the colonial masters, and it has become the bridge between the two communities.
This was a 30-year civil war. I'd like to know how both of you were affected by it.
For me, you know, it is a personal story because I grew up in Sri Lanka, in the capital, Colombo. I had Tamil friends and I grew up with them, and whatever happened, you know, I saw what's coming and we were helpless in a way. In 1983, when the communal riots happened, the turning point of the war, my house was burned down and we were protecting Tamil families. And even now, you know, because we work for the BBC and being Sinhala, many people can't understand, even people in the government can't understand that the BBC Sinhala service is not supporting the government. They think, you know, if you are giving a voice to the Tamil Tigers as well as the government, we are traitors. So, that, you know, my family had been affected. My brothers and sisters and my mother even were told off by neighbors, relatives. Even now, you know, there are people in my family who doesn't talk to me because I'm not taking their side of the war.
Priyat Lianage runs the BBC's Sinhala service, and Maniwanan Tirumalai runs the BBC's Tamil service. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's stay with one of those languages, Sinhala, for eating sideways. That is when we pick a foreign word or phrase that defies easy translation. It's all explained, including the meaning of the expression, eating sideways, in The World in Words number 31. So this week, the Sinhala word in question is kadadat, or kadadat, or maybe kadadat. Somebody, please tell me how to pronounce this. It's spelled K-A-D-A-D-A-T. And what it means is in possession of only half your original teeth. That is brilliant. I love that. Okay, last up today, potatoness, or when is a chip not a chip? Sir Walter Raleigh is reputed to have introduced potatoes from the New World to Britain. Well, now there's a potato-related case in a British tax court involving a New World company. Over to the Big Show's Marco Werman again, and first Alex Galifant, who explains the case.
It concerns a snack food that's popular in Britain called Pringles. I believe you have them here too in the States.
Absolutely, they're everywhere. And they're also in the jungles of Belize and in the urban areas of Iceland.
Okay, well, the thing you need to know first in this story is that in the UK, not all snack foods are taxed equally.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm. Most snacks aren't subject to the British sales tax, but potato snacks are.
Pringles qualifies as a potato snack.
You'd certainly think so. I mean, they look a bit like a potato chip, they're savory like potato chips, they crunch like potato chips, and they're delicious, delicious like potato chips. Indeed, potatoes make up 42% of Pringles.
I don't think this is the end of the matter, is it?
It is not. The American makers of Pringles, Procter & Gamble, don't want to pay that sales tax. So in court, they've been arguing that because the snack also contains 33% fat and has almost no natural potato taste, it does not have the quality of potato-ness required to be considered a potato snack.
They're insulting the concept of potato-ness.
Potato-ness. Indeed, one judge in the case said the issue begged, quote, an Aristotelian question. Does the product have an essence of potato? Procter & Gamble argued no, pointing to Pringles, quote, mouth-melt flavor, uniform color, and a regular shape not found in nature. And since Pringles are manufactured from a dough, they argue that the chips are in fact more like a cake or a biscuit.
Unnatural chip cake. All right, Alex, who won this case, Procter & Gamble or the British tax authorities?
The tax authorities. And as the judges gave their verdict, they pulled another classic Aristotelian maneuver by invoking an imaginary child at a birthday party, arguing that such a child would be better able to decide on Pringle's potato-ness than any food scientist. And in a damning conclusion, the judges rejected Procter & Gamble's claim that Pringles lacked the, quote, essential characteristics of the paradigm potato crisp. Crisp being the British word for chip, but I don't think it would be wise for us to get into that right now.
No, and don't try this at home with your child. The World's Alex Gallifin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And thank you for listening to this podcast. Send me your comments and suggestions, post them on the World in Words Facebook group page, or email me. The address is language@pri.org. Talk to you again next week.